David meant his palace to be the conceptual bridge between Jerusalem's polity and its sanctity, between Jerusalem as it was and Jerusalem as it was meant to be. His palace was the ultimate statement that Jerusalem was meant to be not only the center of Israel's state, but also of Israel's faith. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, Episode 8, The Stones Speak. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Let the stones speak for themselves. So Roger Hertog was told by archaeologist Elat Mazar of blessed memory, whose discoveries have so enhanced our connection to biblical figures. Reflecting on why she avoided conflicts with those archaeologists that sought to deny the scriptural story, Mazar said that she was happy to let the very earth of the Holy Land indicate the truth. As Roger Hertog put it in a beautiful article of appreciation about Mazar, quote, "What made Elat such an eloquent person was that she never engaged in a real conflict with any of them. She would only say, let the stones speak for themselves. Time and scholarship will tell the story." End quote. Elat Mazar has indeed let the stones speak for themselves, and her scholarship allows us to further tell the story of the rise of the city of David. As we have discussed, the Jebusite city of Jerusalem was surrounded by valleys on three sides. This means that the one weak spot was to the northern end of the city, where enemies could approach from above, from the high ground. Jebusite Jerusalem therefore featured, on its northern end, a mitzudah, a fortress. This is archaeological history that was substantiated through the excavations of the archaeologist Kathleen Kenyon, who excavated the original Jebusite Jerusalem. It was this seemingly inconquerable city that David and his general Yoav succeeded in bringing to its knees, and the city became known from that point as Ir David, City of David. We are then informed in the book of Samuel that David asked an ally, Hiram the Phoenician king, to build him a palace in Jerusalem, worthy of a mighty monarch, one that would forever signify the sacred city as the capital of the Jewish people. 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 10. And David went on and grew great, and the Lord God of hosts was with him. And Hiram king of Tyre sent messengers to David, and cedar trees, and carpenters, and masons. And they built David a house. And David perceived that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for his people Israel's sake. David then built a palace in Jerusalem. However, within the original city that, according to the Bible, David conquered, Kathleen Kenyon found no remnant of this grand palace that the Tanakh promises that David had built. This was a problem. David, Kenyon assumed, must have cleared a space within the Jebusite town. But the size of this residence is unlikely to have been that massive, for anything grandiose would have taken too much space within the restricted area of the Jebusite city. This problem, in turn, happened to dovetail directly with a new school of Israeli archaeology made up of those known as the revisionists, who asserted that much of what traditional Jews believed about the glorious history of biblical Israel was fiction. No archaeologist today actually denies David's existence. Any suggestion otherwise has been rendered moot by the discovery of the 9th century BCE inscription at Tel Dan, in which a foreign ruler makes a direct reference to the house of David. But there were archaeologists who insisted that David and Solomon were never mighty kings of united Israel, that they were nomadic tribal chiefs. According to this revisionist view, the biblical description of Jerusalem and of the stories of King David and Solomon were made up centuries later, when the leaders of the southern kingdom of Judah sought a founding myth for their family. But Elat Mazar, contra the revisionists, was convinced that the Bible could provide an answer to the seeming absence of David's palace. And while she was not an Orthodox Jew, she had learned to study the Bible as a source of knowledge from her grandfather and mentor, the archaeologist and remarkable man Binyamin Mazar. As Elat Mazar put it, quote, "One of the many things I learned from my grandfather was how to relate to the biblical text, pore over it again and again, for it contains within it descriptions of genuine historical reality." End quote. And as we previously mentioned in Bible 365, Elat Mazar, in poring over the Bible, hit upon a solution based on a single word. This is chapter 5, verse 7. "But when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines came up to seek David, and David heard of it and went down to the fortress." The word is Vayered, and David went down, descending to his fortress to prepare for war against the Philistines. Assuming that David was given the news of the Philistine attack in his palace, as seems logical, this would mean that David dwelled in a higher part of the city than his fortress. But if, as archaeology indicates, the fortress was built at the highest point in the Jebusite city, then how could David go down to the fortress? It must be, Mazar theorized, that David's palace was built further north, directly above the fortress and outside the original walls of the city that David had conquered. David's palace, then, she argued, would be found just north of the original city, in land that had no houses on it and could easily be excavated. Mazar therefore wrote up an article in the Biblical Archaeological Review in 1997, titled, Let's Excavate David's Palace. But it was only 8 years later in 2005 that she was able to dig, because then, as she tells us, she found someone who would support her vision. Speaking of the Shalem Center in Jerusalem, she writes, quote, At one point, I gave a lecture on my ideas to a seminar there, and the president of the center, Daniel Palasar, was so impressed that he decided to try to help. On a trip to New York, he mentioned the project to the chairman of the center's board of trustees, Roger Hertog. Mr. Hertog courageously took up the challenge to finance the excavation of the site. End quote. Roger Hertog, in turn, tells us that, quote, Eilat's enthusiasm was contagious. Sure enough, her team from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, where she was a professor, quickly began to unearth treasures. I recall the first excited call in which she reported artifacts from the 4th to 7th century BCE, including one bearing the name of Yehuchal, a figure mentioned in the biblical book of Jeremiah. At that point, we agreed to double our investment, end quote. Mazar continued to dig with the faith that the stones would vindicate her. She writes, quote, Almost from the start, ancient remains, preserved beyond all expectations, were unearthed. Adding, Surprisingly, I felt very much at ease throughout the entire excavation. Perhaps what helped me most was the recognition of the importance of what we were doing. And she adds, I would let the stones speak for themselves, end quote. And speak they did. What she uncovered was what is now called the large stone structure, one which reflects the fact that Jerusalem of David's age was not a sleepy town. The building embodies a rejection of the revisionist approach to Jerusalem and David. Here are a few selections, some also cited by Roger Hertog in his article, from Eilat Mazar's write-up of her discovery. Quote, The large stone structure, now seen as a massive structure built on a high scarp, was not just any public building, but a structure that was clearly the product of inspiration, imagination, and considerable economic investment. Moreover, the area had not been previously settled. The site was apparently outside the walls of the Canaanite city. How do we know this? Beneath the large stone structure, the bedrock had been previously leveled, or where cavities were too deep, filled with crushed limestone and made level. And she adds, Did King David, now the ally of the Phoenicians, renowned for their building capabilities, authorize them to build a magnificent new palace for him outside but adjacent to the northern boundary of the old Canaanite city, shortly before the construction of the projected new temple to its north? The biblical narrative, I submit, better explains the archaeology we have uncovered than any other hypothesis that has been put forward. Indeed, the archaeological remains square perfectly with the biblical description that tells us David went down from there to the citadel. So, you decide whether or not we have found King David's palace. End quote. The stones have spoken for themselves. They have told the tale of a Jerusalem that was a significant city from the age of David itself. The story of a Jerusalem that is described by the Bible. To this, I would add a personal, scripturally inspired note as to why it's so interesting and why I have always found it impossible to understand why anyone would believe that the biblical description of David and his palace is a fabricated hagiography. For ladies and gentlemen, what do we know about David's palace? What are the most famous events that occurred there? Let me quote the Bible. And it came to pass in an evening tide that David rose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon. This, of course, is the beginning of David's sin with Bathsheba. It was further in this palace that, according to the Bible, David was confronted by Nathan the prophet, telling him that, Thou hast despised the commandments of the Lord, thou hast killed Uriah, and hast taken his wife to be thy wife. And as we will see, as a punishment for this relationship, David's son Absalom will rebel against him, drive David from this palace, and shame his father before Israel by taking David's concubines to himself on the roof of this palace. The truth is that when we read all that occurred at David's palace, we realize that this biblical text was not written as hagiography, but as memory. And what makes David's story unique is the scripture's brutal honesty. For if David remains our role model today, it is not because he was a perfect leader warrior, but rather because, following this tale, he will emerge as one of the most perfect penitents that the world has ever known. That is why David will be so bound up in our memory and in our image of Jerusalem. It is the remarkable nature of David's spirit that, combined with Mazar's find, allows us to further understand his vision. Why would David build his palace outside the city walls rather than within? The answer, in part, as Mazar herself tells us, can be found in what we know was David's greatest dream, a dream that will ultimately be denied, to build not merely a house for himself, but one for God, a city that would ultimately crown the summit of the mountain. We have mentioned how Jewish tradition will ultimately understand the name Yerushalayim as a combination of Shalem, the political entity conquered by David, and Yirah, awe, reverence, referring to the place where Abraham bound his son and where the temple was destined to be built. The building of a palace beyond the city walls, then, was meant by David as a statement of Jerusalem's ultimate expansion, to include Mount Moriah, to include what would become the center of the Jewish faith. David meant his palace to be the conceptual bridge between Jerusalem's polity and its sanctity, between Jerusalem as it was and Jerusalem as it was meant to be. His palace was the ultimate statement that Jerusalem was meant to be not only the center of Israel's state, but also of Israel's faith. Thus, the remarkable story of Elat Mazar's search for David's palace and how the Bible inspired her search and success reminds us that as we journey through the history of Jerusalem, we must remember that its founding as Israel's capital was bound up with David's dream of what was beyond the Jebusite city itself. Mount Moriah, the locus of his longing, a longing to be imitated by generations following, a longing that the past obligates us to imitate. Let the stones speak for themselves, so Elat Mazar said. And as I wrote in my introduction to the forthcoming Roger and Susan Hertog edition of Leviticus, of the Koran Tanakh of the Land of Israel, Elat Mazar's words parallel reflections of Menachem Begin, expressed as he studied the stones of the Temple Mount during the period of the British Mandate. Begin wrote, quote, "These stones are not silent. They do not cry out. They whisper. They speak softly of the house that once stood there, of kings who knelt here once in prayer, of prophets and seers who here declaimed their message, of heroes who fell here dying, and of how the great flame, at once destructive and illuminating, was here kindled. This was the house and this the country which, with its seers and kings and fighters, was ours before the British were a nation. The testimony of these stones, sending out their light across the generations." End quote. The stones speak for themselves. The stones tell the story of the Jerusalem of David and his dynasty, and of the Jerusalem of David's dreams. The stones, in turn, ask us to make David's vision our own. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.